fundraising, especially in the midst of a difficult financial world in which we live. And so I just clipped some of them. I thought this was kind of cute as we think about the various pitches that we get. At a very swank country club, a young man stood in the lobby watching an old rabbi sitting in front of a table with a plate on which members of the club were supposed to drop donations. The old rabbi had on a shabby-looking suit, a shirt with a dirty collar. His beard was unkempt. He looked like a total mess. Sitting opposite the rabbi was a neatly dressed priest with a spotless white collar, a clean, fresh-pressed suit, and mirror-shine shoes. The plate in front of the priest was overflowing with bills. Everyone entering the club looked at the bedraggled rabbi, then turned to the priest and put a $10 or $20 bill in the priest's plate. Unable to stand it any longer, a young observer walked over to the rabbi and spoke softly. "I've been standing here for over an hour watching this. Every guy who walked into this club over the past hour I know personally, they're all Jews. Yet because you look so bedraggled, they deliberately stopped and placed money in the priest's plate. Wouldn't you be smarter to go home, take a bath, and put on some clean clothes? Then maybe someone would leave a few dollars in your collection plate." The old rabbi put his arm around the young man and smiled warmly. Then he called over to the priest and he said, "Herschel, look who's trying to teach us the business." You remember, it's like the rabbi interviewing for the job or negotiating his contract, and he puts his, you know, one of his kids comes in the middle of the meeting and he knocks at the door and he's wearing a torn shirt. And the rabbi crosses his legs and they see a hole in the bottom of his shoe. So all sorts of varieties of things. There's another one. There's a bunch of these, actually. I may just tell jokes here. I'm actually looking for my haiku. I'm really trying to find my haiku. You may be out of the haiku. You may have to come back. You may have to publish those. That's what happens when you have 72 pages of notes and you actually prepare. That's really tough when that happens. Oh, there it is. One more. An American tourist in Tel Aviv was about to enter the impressive Mann Auditorium to take in a concert by the Israeli Philharmonic. He was admiring the unique architecture, the sweeping lines of the entrance, and the modern decor throughout the building. Finally, he turned to his escort and asked if the building was named for Thomas Mann, the world-famous author. "No," said his friend, "it's named for Frederick Mann from Philadelphia." "Really? I never heard of him. What did he write?" The answer? The check. Some Jewish haiku before we get to the business at hand, talking more about journeys. I tell you, I'm speaking extemporaneously next year. Too many notes. I'm not used to preparation. Thank you, Bruce. On your behalf. The religious practices used to be run by two Bruces here, you know? So anyway, lacking fins or tails, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. This one for you, Mr. Lefkowitz. Rosh Hashanah services quietly murmured. Red Sox 3, Yanks 5. For our upcoming B'nai Mitzvah, whose parents, despite what I just said, will be very nervous about their kids doing this exactly right. Hopefully I've set a role model of what it's like to not do it right for so many years. It'll be okay. Today I am a man. Tomorrow I will return to the seventh grade. Beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. We started asking what makes this night different from all other nights last night before Danny gave a very stirring presentation. On Passover, we opened the door for Elijah. Now our cat is gone. Are going over much better than I thought. You may hear nothing but these. "Mom, please, there's no need to put that dinner roll in your pocketbook." Pardon me? My mom too. 7-foot Jews in the NBA, slam dunking. My alarm clock rings. Come on, Bruce, you gotta smile at one. Your parents are laughing.
They only see you once a year.
That's why they're laughing too. We only see them once a year. Hard to tell under the lights. White yarmulke or male pattern baldness? Two more, and then I'll let you. I'm not going to let you go. That's when we're going to start. Okay. Is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? And then finally, Yenta, Schmir, Gavalch, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Meshuga, Oi, to be fluent. All righty. Thank you, whoever sent that to me. I don't remember. I didn't mark it. So the courage to make one's life a blessing, you know, after giving you a little background to the journey that I've been on during this past year, wanted to continue to talk about things that I've learned. Someone asked me last night, I overheard a conversation, someone reported to me. The people were interested about my family's response. I shared our daughter's response to finding out that her father had cancer. I did tease her a bit, although she did ask if she could put in what she wanted in the will. She also started to call pretty regularly, and this is the girl about whom I spoke on Rosh Hashanah, for whom we've shared many silent moments. And in a certain way, perhaps, that was part of the journey in order to sort of turn the heart of the father toward the daughter and back. It's interesting, the amount of conversation we now have, something I'll always treasure. I'm sorry it was for that reason. But not to be too nice to her at one of the moments of bleakness, reminding me perhaps why we don't talk to each other that much. After complaining about something, I get a message on my answering machine, and it says, "Hey, Rabbi," and I'm gonna have to really clean this up, otherwise my wife will never speak to me again. She leaves this message, and she says, "Hey, Rabbi." And then she says, "In case you didn't understand it, that's what it sounds like when you have your head you know where." But you know what? My wife and I agree there's probably one person on the planet that could have said that, and she was the one. And I called her back and thanked her for that telephone call. I mentioned our son who's in Indiana, the expectant father, and how he asked if I would look good in a dress at his brother's wedding. Okay, hopefully their child will remain in our will. I'm not sure he will. But then, one of the special moments, because of the radioactivity, was taking an airplane and saying to our daughter-in-law when we found out she was pregnant and knowing that during the pregnancy, at least during the treatment, I would be unable to hug her, that I flew out there and asked, "Can I meet you for lunch?" She said, "How come?" I said, "I want to give you a hug and I may not be able to now for a while." And so I flew out there and we met. I never even saw her husband, our son, but I did give her that hug and that was very special. You know, I have a kid locally in law school. Trying to get through to him sometimes can be like getting through to the Supreme Court. And yet, every time I would call and indicate I'd been to the doctor, I got a return call. And I'll never forget those return calls. His wife, every step of the way, when I looked to somebody in the family who would be there, we had more lunches and cups of coffee. I'm surprised she's still employed because we met every time after the doctor's appointment. And I'll always treasure those moments. You know, I've often wondered if there were any redeeming characteristics of our 19-year-old. And every time he would see me look down, he would come out with that look on his face, and he would say, "It's time for a hug." And he would come up and he would wrap me in a hug. And folks, what I've learned is important at times like this, is the opportunity to be able to share in those moments, to be able to reach beyond the disagreements that we may have in families. It's fascinating to me to watch people come up onto the bima on Yom Kippur, which I think is a high-stress Jewish occasion, and watch the interactions that go on between people on this bima as husbands and wives are trying to figure out who's gonna deal with this little contraption. Who's gonna stand at which door? Whether you should stand at this door or that door. Who's gonna do what? And to realize that part of the journey is encountering situations in life that remind us that there are certain things that transcend some of the static that goes on in our lives. And hopefully, with whoever it is we wish to remain close, we'll be able to find ways to be able to do for others what was lovingly done for me by members of my family. I could certainly try to speak about the support that my companion and friend has given me throughout this period of time, but one of our children complains that these services are too long anyway, and so to be able to share all that would keep us here probably through Yom Kippur of next year and beyond. So let me share something that I wrote right around Passover as part of this experience, because part of what I was trying to find in terms of my journey was a way in which to let Judaism come into my life in the midst of this. And so I will be sharing two experiences, one which I wrote right around Passover, and the other which happened when I went to visit the mikvah. Dear friends and family, April 15th, as we get ready to celebrate the conclusion of Passover, I wanted to update you on my thoughts. I appreciate your willingness to read these and to offer your supportive comments. I will find out soon the date of the seed implantation in June and the challenges that that will bring. I spent a lot of time thinking about the metaphor of going from slavery to freedom, which is part of our Passover ritual. I feel I am sometimes overwhelmed by the effects of the hormones inside of me and the potential for mood swings which can grip me at any time. I find myself hard to live with sometimes. I only wonder how Sue is handling this person who can become so intensely negative almost instantly. The hot flashes are very intense and increase in length sometimes when they occur. The silver lining is that they are becoming less frequent. I also feel oppressed by fatigue. The nights of waking up every hour to take that familiar trek to visit the necessary are beginning to wear me out. The most serious issue, though, that I'm facing is I'm becoming fearful that perhaps I'll be in the 1% or the 5% and the 10%, and that the treatment won't work, and I will have endured this for nothing. The theme of doubt. I'm also beginning to worry, I am a worrier, about side effects from the procedure. And I know rationally the things I'm worrying about are unlikely, but in cases like this, the non-rational is very strong. Ministering to many who are dealing with cancer now has been challenging, as I hear of their stories and know their struggles. At any one time, I think how thankful I am that I have a very small tumor with such a high probability of cure, and I struggle with why I am so lucky and others are dealing with things much more serious. Then I feel like a spiritual wimp for not having more faith that I will really be okay, and that I'm complaining about something that is really very minor in the grand scheme of things. I don't know what to do about this, but I guess maybe this struggle is all I can do about it right now. After all, Jacob struggled with an angel over a very intense night and emerged with a new name and a limp. I wonder who I will become and whether there will be any lasting wounds. I think the most significant issue that I'm facing is that I feel an intense pressure to fill every day with as much life as possible, because of the growing recognition that life on this planet is not forever. If there is any message I continue to wish to share, it is that we shouldn't wait to do things that are important for us, and we should treasure time with family and friends. Michael and I were playing catch and taking batting practice while I was home on spring break. He did hit 5 or 6 balls over the fence off me, making me think I may be closer to leaving this planet than I thought. In a different context, he mentioned to me that perhaps things work out the way they are supposed to. And I wonder if perhaps this year of challenge is a message of some kind. Still trying to figure out that one. In less than 7 weeks, we will be celebrating Shavuot, I wrote, our festival which commemorates the giving of the Torah in Mount Sinai, the time at which the Jewish people celebrates our revelation there. As part of our ritual, we count the Omer, a grain offering. I realize that with this festival on May 29th and 30th, it'll be 1 or 2 more weeks after that till I have the treatment, which will be my own new special revelation. Aaron continues to remind me to hang in there and to not look back and regret things that did or didn't happen. Adam and I went to opening day, and it reminded me of joyful moments which we can share. I think about my mom a lot in the midst of this journey because she didn't talk much and wonder what she would say to nurture me. I believe she would remind me to celebrate the good times, and then 99% of the things we were about never happened. I hope she's right in this situation and long for a hug that only a mother can give. She would tell me to find joy in the routines of life and not just to wait to celebrate big events, which are infrequent in comparison to the happiness of being able to live each day. My dad would tell me to keep looking for the pony, as I've written before, and to smell the roses. We hope to have beautiful peonies this year, which were my mom's favorite. Finally, I continue to marvel at Sue's patience and hope that deep inside she's as optimistic as she tells me she is. I couldn't get through this without her love and support. Folks, I've shared from this Bema before as part of my personal journey at other times, the tension between one of my brothers and myself. He wrote, "Hey Bruce, wish I had some wonderful words of advice for you. Just remember that old ass stubbornness. Your father used to always remind us to stop and smell the roses. Sometimes we feel we need strong reminders about what is important." Another note that I got from somebody was, trying to find the spot. "I want to thank you for sharing your email with me, as it was very emotionally touching and revealing about what you have been and continue to go through in your fight against cancer. I've always admired your great skill of crafting metaphors through biblical stories in everyday life. And once again, your email was successful to me in this way. How can you call yourself a spiritual wimp when you have dedicated your life to being a rabbi with all the hundreds or thousands of people that you have helped, comforted, inspired while walking along your own spiritual path? You chose this difficult life for yourself because of a desire to help others who could possibly not help themselves, or perhaps you wanted to make a difference in this world and be a role model for your people. Whatever the reason, you had and still have the courage to be willing to undertake this challenge. Just as God chose Moses to lead our ancestors out of bondage into the promised land, so he chose you to do this good work. I believe and I know that it is not your faith that has faltered, but it's the fear of the future and the unknown that occasionally invades your thoughts. That only makes you human." So then a conversation with a member of the congregation. To fast forward the tape, standing at Adam Katz's graveside, a conversation when I shared with Hazel Solomon how I doubted at that moment, when so many of us doubted, when so many of our faith were certainly challenged, if not shattered in many ways. And I said, "Hazel, maybe it's time for me to change professions. Maybe through the journey about which she was aware that I've been going through and this recent event, maybe it's time to acknowledge, you know what? Got too many doubts. After all, Moses didn't get into the promised land because he doubted God's word after his sister died. Wasn't sure talking to a rock would get water to come out from it. So he hit the rock and God said, you didn't have faith that talking to the rock would let the water out. And so I thought, if Moses couldn't get to the promised land, maybe, my faith just isn't strong enough." And folks, Hazel said to me, as the doctor in his email wrote to me, that that's what it means to be human, and that your rabbinate should never stand in the way of your being human. And folks, that's probably the most important lesson that I've learned. We can't let the things that become so important in our lives, that clutter our spiritual inboxes, we can't and we mustn't let them become the focus. We must remember that, as Rabbi Hillel said, in a place, in a world where no one is being human or where people are not being as humane as they might be, whatever our calling, whatever our profession, whatever our journey through life, we should strive to be human. because it's each one of us who has the opportunity to be able to reach out and to be able to give someone that hug, give someone that advice, have a catch with someone, do whatever it is brings you together with the people you care about. We all have that opportunity to be human, and sometimes we forget it because we're too busy trying to do whatever it is we're trying to do. And folks, when we gather at a grave, or whether when we're faced with challenges which life can bring us, I think our humanity in the end is just about perhaps all we've got. Do we know? Somebody asked me, actually, a member of the congregation asked me, what happened if Abraham and Isaac had no conversation with each other going up the mountain? What did they talk about when they went down the mountain? And we had a long discussion about the fact that Abraham might have come down on his own, or maybe they were of one faith and one belief after the experience of the Akedah. We don't know, but the language suggests that only one of them came down, and it's a mystery. But interesting that we see Isaac again after this traumatic experience. Isaac, you know where he was? He was at Be'er Lahai Roi. Anybody remember what happened at that spot in the Torah? It's the place where Hagar, the stepmother of Isaac, ran away to when she could no longer endure the mistreatment that she received as a maid in the house of Sarah. She ran out of the house with no idea of where she was going to go. She didn't know where she was going. She didn't care where she was going. All she knew was she couldn't take it anymore where she was. She was exhausted and sick at heart. She was worn out from the abuse she had received. She was in deep despair. And so she went away and somehow stumbled into this place called Be'er Lahai Roi. And there she met an angel of God who comforted her and who promised her that God saw her suffering and that God would help her. Now comes the insight of a colleague, Rabbi Gutov, who said that Isaac went there at this moment when he had suffered perhaps an unspeakable experience, a father almost taking his life from him. He went there to see if in his moment of challenge on his journey, he could comfort Hagar, the mother of the stepbrother who gave him a hard time, and lift her spirits a little bit. Folks, when we are at our lowest point in life, when we are struggling with what to do when facing challenges in our lives, can we go to the places where we can help comfort others and perhaps comfort someone who we never ever would have thought we would go comfort, or say something that we never thought we could have the courage to say? Why? Because it makes us human. And it was in comforting this mother of his stepbrother that Isaac got the strength to be able to move onward and to be able to climb out of his own black hole, perhaps, to meet Rebecca and to continue the chain of tradition from Abraham to Isaac on to Jacob. It was within 2 days of the treatment when I wrote, "Dear friends, yesterday was mikveh day. And I hope that no one will report me." By the way, a mikveh is a ritual bath that many people go to. Women go there, okay, before they're getting married often. People will sometimes go there, particular women, and after their monthly cycle. There are times that people will bring their dishes there to make them purified for Passover. People go there when they convert to Judaism. It's a ritual bath. I was looking for a Jewish ritual to perform before I had my procedure. And so after many very intense conversations, I went to the mikveh. And I hope nobody will report me to the police, since I almost ran a stop sign. I turned right at a red light where there was no turn on red. Clearly, I was apprehensive about this spiritual encounter. And I showed up 15 minutes late, not a surprise for any of you, but a surprise for her. When I got there, she asked me, "Why are you here?" By the way, for those of you who have experienced this woman at the mikveh, Naomi, she certainly is young enough to be one of our children, and I felt kind of interested and weird being guided by somebody who is as young as one of our children. I guess that's a sign of old age. We talked about a number of things. She asked me why I was so afraid, because I shared with her my fears of the upcoming procedure. Why was I so doubtful? And she said, why are you afraid and doubtful when there's a 98% chance the doctors are telling you that you could be cured with minimal pain and discomfort? She said, can't you? It's a harsh question, folks, coming from a 30-year-old. She asked me, it's a harsh question coming from anybody. She asked me about my faith. And she said, can't you find enough faith to fill the 2% of your doubt? I told her I thought I could, but I was still filled with doubt about whether God would find me deserving of healing. I think she was surprised that I was filled with that kind of doubt, but assured me that all of us have self-doubt at one time or another. We then had a conversation about why I was really at the mikvah. I told her I was scared. She told me that the water could wash away my fears in some fashion. She suggested that I use the nigun for the service that concludes Shabbat, that does Havdalah for us, that we could all sing together, that is the la-la-la, that separates Shabbat from the rest of the week. She said, do sing that blessing about going into the mikvah to that tune as you struggle to separate between being sick and being healthy. I have to tell you, for those of us facing challenges, if you emerge on the other side or you reach a point where you want to go forward, try it. Say the words that are in your heart with which you are struggling, and say them to the words of that nigun, to the song melody of that nigun. Because if you do that, it can mark the separation between that which is troubling you and that which can cause you to move forward. I told her more than anything, one of the things that I was afraid of was that my life would be a blessing if I am cured from the cancer, and that I wanted to separate that which is not meaningful to me from that which is meaningful to me. She listened attentively to me, and then she asked me if it ever occurred that perhaps my life was a blessing, and that perhaps when we look to make changes in our lives, maybe we don't need to separate from that which we have in our hearts, but maybe we just need to remember that which is in our hearts. And in that way, we will be able to live meaningful lives and truly make our lives into a blessing. I wrote at that time, I guess I could ask instead of, is anyone still reading this? Is anyone still listening to this? She told me to go into the mikvah. I did. And I emerged from that mikvah. And then I had the treatment. And then I suffered the side effects from the treatment. And then we went to Alaska. And I will close at this time by telling you that doctors can tell you that along your journey that something can happen and that something will happen. People can tell us when we're growing up that we can accomplish great things. Loved ones can tell us that they love us. But until we believe it, it really doesn't matter in certain ways what they tell us. Until we have faith, until we confront our doubts, it really doesn't matter as much what people tell us as whether we believe them. And in those moments of silence that I told you about on Rosh Hashanah, standing there looking at Mount McKinley, standing at Wonder Lake, standing there with my wife and daughter, in that silence, and then later that night looking at the stars of the Milky Way, I began to believe that a cure was possible. And I began to believe that on my journey from the Beltway to the Milky Way, I had found faith on a journey that I never wanted to take, and that I hope others don't have to take, but that we all, one time or another, are going to have to take. And my hope and prayer is that wherever life takes you, whatever journeys you're on, that you will be able to enjoy the blessing of renewed faith, renewed hope, and that you will be able to share the love with at least one person that I've been blessed with by so many. It's just thinking, because I like to play with numbers, that finding out the news and worrying that it might be my last Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur last year, and then adding up the numbers of the road I was on when I got the diagnosis from the doctor, I realize that if you add up the numbers for 495, it's 4 plus 9 plus 5, and that adds up to 18. That adds up to life. It says in Deuteronomy, I place before you life and death. I hope and pray that my life will continue to manifest as a choice of choosing to make my life a blessing, as we continue once more with the choir singing the conclusion.